last one, one of the ones I did recorded fine, but then when they were transferring it over to CD, they lost the front half. So we had to just redo that part.
Okay. I know that we just had you fill out some of this type of information, but I'd like to start off by the simple background questions. What was the date and place of your birth?
Okay, I was born September 2nd, 1949 in La Crosse, Wisconsin. I actually grew up about an hour south of here.
Okay. In La Crosse?
Between Ettrick and Gelsville, two tiny little towns.
Okay.
In the country on a farm. So La Crosse was actually slightly farther away than Winona, but those are the two
big
towns
cities
that we'd go to.
How do you designate your race?
Caucasian.
And what is your ancestry or ethnicity?
Norwegian.
Norwegian?
Yes.
Great. How many male and or female siblings do you have?
I have a fraternal twin sister and a 3 years younger brother.
That's cool.
So I'm the oldest, but only by 15 minutes. And my sister Lorna always seemed to be the oldest. I was kind of spacey, and she took care of us all, I think.
You already answered that one. What is the name and occupation of your partner or spouse, if you have one?
My husband is Mark Helland, and he is a small business owner.
Oh, do you mind me asking what business he owns?
Well, it's always hard to explain. It's one business that has spun off into three or four, but they're all involved with professional education, one-day seminars for people that need to maintain credits in there.
Okay.
So contract law for contractors. There's one that's mostly now education in the medical fields. The one he's working with right now is for accountants and maybe lawyers. Had four teenage boys living with us 1 year, and at the supper table, we finally just decided he was a part of the Norwegian mafia because we really couldn't explain what else he was
doing.
Yeah.
That's a good explanation. How many children do you have, if any, boys, girls?
One daughter and one son, who's 3 years younger than she is.
How old's your daughter?
She's 33. He's 30. They both live in Burlington, Vermont for now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Quite a ways away.
Yeah, Alyssa has been there forever, it seems like. She's just got married last year, but a friend of hers found both an apartment and a job for our son, so that's how he ended up out there.
That's how it is with my brother. How many grandchildren, if any, boys and girls?
No grandchildren.
No grandchildren. And where did you attend school and what degrees have you earned?
I went to Luther College in Decorah, Iowa, where I got a BA in biology. And then took some time off. And then got my master's in physiology from the University of Minnesota, although it was really a neuromuscular doctoral program.
Okay.
That was beginning, just as starting up. I was a guinea pig for it at Mayo Clinic. But I ended up with a master's in physiology.
Oh, nice.
So it's from the University of Minnesota, Masters of Science. But the degree is Mayo Graduate School of Medicine, research fellow in physiology. So the degree isn't it. You know,
oh,
I never
okay.
know what to say. U of M. But it really, although I had been working there, so I got a couple of classes in when I was working up at the university before going to Mayo.
Oh.
And then took a bunch more time off and came back here and got a Bachelor of Science degree in education. So.
Nice. Was that done right here in Eau Claire?
Yes.
Okay. Is there anything else about your general background that you think is important that you want to mention?
Well, I was talking to my husband about this, especially when we're talking feminism. We actually married after our junior year in college, so I was 20 when I got married, barely, and we're 19, and so our 40th anniversary is coming up this year.
Congratulations.
So it's, it actually took him being gone for the summer at he was an intern out in Washington, D.C., for me to actually see what it was like to be a single career girl.
Oh, okay.
But, so that's kind of adds to my path, I guess.
Yeah, it very much does. Describe your relationship with your parents and siblings while you were growing up.
I feel like we all got along. My dad and mom were both very hardworking, so I don't remember them either spending a lot of time playing with us or hovering over us, either one of those. When they were out milking cows, the three children would be in, getting into mischief inside, dressing the dog or or whatever. But we did know that they were proud of us. Mom was always bragging, and that they loved us.
Yeah.
When they weren't working on the farm, they were working off the farm. So in later childhood, Mom would be up really early going off to be a cook at the school, and Dad would be gone working at the canning factory. And so we were left again kind of at our own devices to get up and get ready for school.
Did you guys do a lot of farm work?
Actually, no. Sometimes helped with feeding chickens or gathering eggs. We were allowed to milk one of the cows. We milked by hand, the pet cow. My dad was the youngest of quite a few siblings, all of whom lived nearby. And we were the youngest cousins by quite a bit. But one of his nieces actually died on a tractor as a child. And I think he made the decision that we weren't going to get too involved in their farm work.
That's interesting. So since you were living within the same vicinity, it sounds like of your like aunts and uncles?
Yes. In fact, if I'd go on a date, I loved his saying, as someone picked me up and then we drove back into town, I'd say, well, my cousin lives here and I have two uncles up in that community, in that coulee, we called them, in Trumbull County. And there's my cousin and there's another uncle and there's my cousin. I'm not sure why I did that, whether it was you better be nice to me or else kind of thing.
Someone will see you.
I'm surrounded by protecting people. Yeah, so.
Did they help out a lot with the farm, like helping you?
There was a lot of movement back and forth for big events. If you were going to do haying, you'd do it one place and then the other. They'd share equipment once in a while. And
cheaper that way.
Yeah, and so, you know, there'd be big meals to feed them if they were all at one place or the other.
Awesome.
So. Some visiting in the evenings, not too much. Sunday afternoons, we might go to an aunt or uncle's. Would go to early on to get baths. We would go to an aunt and uncle, I know, because we didn't have an indoor bath room at the time.
Okay.
So, yeah, it was nice.
We kind of partially touched on this, but tell me about the community and neighborhood where you grew up. Probably more focused on the community.
Well, I think. The farming neighborhood was our community, mostly relatives, some others. The social network was our rural church, So even though the towns were about 5 miles away, we rarely went into town because the church was right there in the rural community as well. We also had 4-H that we were involved in, and that was local as well with various parents of classmates in charge. And my mother was a part of the homemakers, local homemakers group, which I think was a part of the county extension. And so they, our involvement was just in that neighborhood. Both parents were somewhat involved in both 4-H and church, more mom than dad.
Describe how your family was or was not connected to the community and neighborhood. So, were you and your siblings ever in 4-H as well?
Yes. Yes. So, I think in those regards, our parents' lives probably were similar to ours in that they were as involved as leaders. And then we came in as the children who were involved from the child's aspect.
Who had power and privilege in your community, and how did that affect you and your family?
I never thought about power and privilege, and as I think back at it, we were so homogeneous, and I think it was very egalitarian. Even went to a one-room country school for my first, well, I went to kindergarten in town, bused into town. I always sat with my cousin, who was in high school, on the bus. So that was, you know, that was the big adventure. And then back into the one-room school that was a mile away for first through sixth grades. So it was pretty egalitarian. High school, probably power and privilege, you had this sense that maybe the people in town had a bit more power and privilege. The town kids would be slightly better off. I remember on a date going to this fellow's basement where there was a fireplace, you know, pretty unimagined in the country.
Yeah.
But I was somewhat oblivious to that whole thing. We were all poor equally, and for the most part, except some of the town kids, but it wasn't a big deal.
Yeah.
So there wasn't that sense of, I think power comes in part when you're having to prove something to someone different from yourself. But maybe not.
What values did you learn from your family and other people and institutions in the community?
I think it's the old Protestant work ethic, as well as the Minnesota nice. Those two concepts pretty much describe my growing up as well. Be nice and work hard.
I think I already touched on, oh no, that was your husband. What occupations did your parents pursue? You said the canning factory?
Yeah, so they both farmed. We had shorthorn cattle, which were dairy cattle, but also would provide some beef. They were kind of a cross. And Mom, at least early on, had lots of chickens. I'm not sure when Dad started working at the canning factory. He would, more so in the summer, he would do some of the planting and some of the spraying of pesticides. And Mom, well, and then in the winter, he often worked for the town, helping to plow snow. And Mom,
kind of seasonal jobs?
So, yeah, a summer job and a winter job, plus his farming. And then Mom would do cooking in the school during the school year. So they were always busy because then they come home and have to do the farm work yet at night.
What lessons did you learn from each parent?
Well, I think the lessons of the whole community, be nice, work hard. If I think back, some negative, you know, there are always things that you say, I'm not going to be like this with my parents. And we tended to see that maybe from my mother's point of view, that my dad approached life very laid back. I think she would have wished that he would have been a bit more aggressive. And Mom, on the other hand, I felt she was a bit too inquisitive and demanding, and so probably tried to hit that area in between a little bit. But I tend to not ask any questions, and that's, you miss out that way as well, so.
Yeah. What role did education play in your life?
A very important role all along. I loved school, although I think Mom had a hard time getting me to kindergarten at least once or twice, and I'm wondering what in the world happened, but I know that I felt bad because I was supposed to take a nap and I couldn't sleep, and, you know, it's like I'm not doing what I'm supposed to do. I was probably, this kindergarten stuff is awful because,
yeah.
Anyway, but once I got past kindergarten, I loved school. I know we were so proud when the bus couldn't get up our coulee, but we walked to school, tromping through the snow, so we could get there. Because, again, that was a place where was our social network as well. Then I went to 7th and 8th grade back in the town grade school, and then high school was a high school that connected both the Ettrick and the Galesville people, who were the two towns on either side of us. Our phone was Galesville and our address was Ettrick, and so we never really felt connected to either, or connected to both, maybe would be a better way to say it.
So you lived kind of right on the line? Or
Yeah. In between the two. So it was important then, and when I went straight into college and loved studying, loved being a student, went off to work at the University of Minnesota, where I did research for two MDs in the infectious disease pediatrics department. But even there, I was taking classes that you could take free, get classes, so I took some graduate school classes there. So after Mark graduated from law school there, then he started practicing for a couple of years in Stuartville, Minnesota, where he had grown up, which allowed me then, and luckily I had been chosen to be a part of this guinea pig program at Mayo, so yeah. I went back to school there until we ended up moving. He didn't like being a lawyer, and a college friend said, how about coming to Eau Claire and we'll start up these businesses? So that's what we did.
Nice. Can you give an example of how gender, race, ethnicity, and social class were important in building your understanding of yourself and society?
Well, it was a pretty idyllic childhood with church, school, friends, relatives, everybody the same, everybody friendly. I think because of that basic homogeneity, I didn't develop any negative stereotypes. What else? I have here... Well, as far as gender issues, our class in this one-room grade school was 8, 4 girls, 4 boys, which was huge. Most of the classes were 1, 2, 3 students. And so both as far as ageism in those growing up years or genderism, there was none. We all had to play together because there were so few of us. I think the only class ethnicity or social class issues would be this sense that there were some non-Norwegian, non-Lutherans around, Irish or Polish Catholics. So I was really proud of myself that I was friends with a Catholic girl who had lots of siblings. So that was my only look at someone slightly different from myself. And my dad was not in the military, and so he never developed or passed on any negative stereotypes. I think people in the military get brainwashed into developing negativity towards others so that they can manage to fight them. And so, again, it could also be just my head up in the clouds feel. So, as far as seeing someone discriminated against, the only thing would be my one of my classmates was a boy at the time who maybe had some emotional, mental problems, acted out more than the norm. I always felt sorry for him and thought that he was, the punishments that he got were more severe than the crime. And so it probably helped me develop a little empathy. We also had, our next door neighbors were even poorer than we were, and their father was an alcoholic. He would come weaving down our driveway. And we would go up to their house quite often as kids. I'm not sure our parents particularly liked that. But it was a different place, something to do. They were a bit older than us and let us hang around, and so really liked them. But there was a sense of empathy or feeling sorry for them, too, as partly because of their dad, probably more so because they were even poorer than we were. They didn't even have electricity. So that was all I had. And even, you know, ever since, really, there hasn't been that much opportunity to be closely involved with very many people different from me.
What memories do you have of being discriminated against or seeing others who were victims of discrimination? Like possibly an example of the boy?
Yeah, I think I've pretty much answered that one.
Including all the way up into your college years as well?
I remember I really didn't sense any discrimination. I went to Luther College. There were some African Americans there. I wanted to approach and didn't approach someone in my dorm because I didn't know how to act, which is sad. Yeah. I didn't want to come across as them thinking I was being overly nice because they were different from me. And so I kind of left it. But I did go on a couple of dates with a black guy in college. But there just weren't that many around. And so I didn't sense that discrimination. Certainly, race issues were paramount throughout the 60s when I was in high school and college. But it was from afar that I would experience and begin to understand this discrimination. I guess I would see myself, kind of the 12 and 13 questions there, hopefully that I would see myself as compassionate. I certainly did not understand or sense that there was something I could do at that time that would change things, nor did I understand the sense of my white privilege, or that I needed and should embrace diversity. Those just were not a part of what I studied or understood.
What memories of your childhood continue to make a difference in your life?
Well, I think my both my church and school experiences were very positive, and I excelled both places, and because it was a small community and small sizes, it gave me the opportunity to participate in a lot of things. You didn't have to really try out so much to be in band. If you were the one that wanted, I was on the District Luther League board or something. If you wanted it, you know, all you had to do was volunteer. So I think, if anything, I learned that leadership, without having the angst about it, it just kind of fell into my lap. And as a result, I think when I'm asked to do things, if I have the time and I'm willing, I don't think too much about it. I just jump in, and usually it works.
Positive thing.
Yeah.
What significant historical events do you recall most clearly from your childhood, and how have they affected you throughout your lifetime?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is the Beatles. Not exactly, but it really was a historical event.
Yes.
I mean, all of a sudden, the world opened up more, and this was a different world than I had been used to. Certainly, JFK assassination, I remember being in high school and sitting down on the gym floor. We learned about it in the middle of Viad. And then in college, Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy assassinations. Vietnam War going on through this whole time. So I know that a good friend in college had a really low lottery number and ended up heading off to war. Marx was low, but he had double vision from severe car accident, and so he was not capable of going. You know, you got to be able to see one soldier, two soldiers,
yeah,
not two soldiers in your viewfinder, I imagine. So, wasn't out there then being much of an activist, although I certainly had this sense of being anti-war, anti-discrimination throughout those years. Really never acted on them.
Looking back at your childhood, would you have anticipated that you would become a feminist later in life?
In retrospect, looking back, I guess I can see that I had a really strong mom, and who was always working, and my dad was always working too, but he was the one that I would go to tie the sash on my dress and spread out the bow beautifully. So I think they both showed were willing to not fit the stereotypes, show their masculine and feminine sides. It was just commonplace, and I didn't think of it, see it as out of the ordinary. I also think that because of the smallness of the size and the homogeneity and my abilities, there was never that sense of feeling inferior. And so I think all of those things probably helped to play a role.
What else would you like to share about your childhood experiences? Any sibling stories or?
Most of my stories of my siblings are good ones. My sister and I, with our doll buggies going down the rows of the cornfields, or helping my brother dig holes in a big pile of earth and make caves, or follow him up to the sand bar where we would do sandbox things, or But I was also a bit of a loner as a child. I was a bookworm. My siblings were not. So I'd spend a lot of time just on my own.
Reading,
yeah.
Describe your, I think we kind of went through that, your educational path after high school.
Yeah, I think, immediately to college, then 2 years of research, then graduate school, and then a bunch of years as a mother and a volunteer before I returned here to get an education degree. I'd taken a course here where we looked at personality styles and determined from that people like me were happy and successful as teachers, which was the first time I'd considered doing that. And so then I took those classes. But in the middle of that, was asked to start teaching here. So I've been here, UWEC, on and off, mostly part-time for probably going on 20 years. We did move out to Colorado Springs for a couple of years in the middle of that, but here I am.
Did you do any work out in Colorado Springs?
No, I had looked into it, but the university job out there would have included microbiology, which I hadn't had in a long time, although that's what my college work-study program was, in the microbiology lab. But it was also nighttime work, and I didn't need to work, and I wanted to be home for my kids, who were not at a great age to move. They were in middle school, early high school. So I became pretty bored and pretty depressed out there because I'd left all of my connections back here. But no, I didn't work out there.
Describe, I think you've also done that. When and how were you awakened to the social inequities based on gender, race, social class, sexual orientation, and any other layers of identity?
I would say very, very slowly aware. I became educated on gender issues, I think, through my association with AAUW, which I was doing. I was a member of AAUW throughout my children's childhood. I've been trying to think when I first joined it. But in studying issues, deciding what issues we wanted to pursue locally, it was just a very slow awakening to the fact that there were those kinds of issues out there. I certainly saw racial inequality in the media, but had no experience with it. I was involved shortly after I started working at the university here in a week-long immersion experience where a number of faculty spent a week out at the Sinta Gleshka four-year Native American college in Red Bud, South Dakota. I slept in a tent in the backyard of one of the leaders of the Dakota group there and learned some of the language, some of the customs, some of the religion. And so I think that too was a chance to understand some of those issues that you otherwise wouldn't get. Embrace the differences, learn from each other.
Sounds like an interesting trip.
Yes, that continued for a number of years. People would come here. We'd have some classes. I helped build a sweat lodge out, I think it was at Beaver Creek, 1 year. And so, yeah, it was a good experience.
What memories do you have of your first encounter with a feminist or the subject of feminism?
I would say it wasn't until I began my association with women's studies program here. And that began because I think because of my AAUW experiences when the cross-listed course, Women in the Life Sciences, was available to me. I took it, and then since I was teaching a women's studies cross-listed course, I felt it imperative that I get to know the women's studies department and begin to understand a bit more about feminism, feminist ideology, the feminist pedagogy, and but it's an ongoing process. I think every field has its vocabulary, mm-hmm. and we use it so often and so well that we realize others don't really understand what it is we're talking about. So you as both a biologist and a women's studies, you see those two
very difficult
vocabularies, and yeah. they're very different from one another. So it's an ongoing process for me through the workshops that I attend, the reading that I do.
What resistance, if any, did you face from the people you cared about when you became a feminist? I kind of have a quick question, because it's kind of assuming, like, do you declare yourself as a feminist, or do you just align yourself with some of the ideologies, maybe? I don't know if I'm
that's
supposed
a,
to
yeah,
come
that's
out and
an
ask
interesting,
that, but I feel like it's assuming.
I consider myself a feminist. My husband's and children are very supportive of that. I think they see me more as being a liberal than a feminism is part of being liberal. It would be interesting to know if there are many political conservatives that consider themselves feminist or not. There have been, and so if someone says, "Are you a feminist?" I would say yes to them, and not a big deal. Mm-hmm. And I think throughout the various waves of feminism, mm-hmm. I would be on their side, but again, mostly as an onlooker. There have been some problems with that, some concern that my sister, my twin sister and I can't talk politics, we can't talk religion. I think I could talk feminism with her if I could, you know, take it away from those two things. Mm-hmm. We tend to be on the opposite poles. Even though she's a strong working woman, because of her religious beliefs, she says the man is the head of the household, which, you know, if I had a better relationship with her, I've always been the one that's had life come easier. She's always been a little envious, so I have to step kind of lightly, otherwise I look like I'm pompous and preaching. And
yeah.
So, but I think I would, you know, it would be nice to be able to say to her, well, it's easy for you to say that because you are in a good relationship and you do really work together. And
so
you
it's
do
okay.
really. Yeah, yeah, so it's okay to say he's the head of the household. But you do most of the head of the household hold stuff, you know.
Yeah.
But that's aside from the point. And I also. Again, it's easy for me to identify myself that way, and there are just some people I can't confront. Another one is, just came up this last weekend, we were in Rochester, Minnesota, and hooked up with Mark's old high school buddy and his wife, and she said, made some crack about a book she was reading, seemed to be full of feminist stuff. And Mark was the one that said, oh, aren't you a feminist? And I don't feel I knew her well enough. I mean, we see each other maybe once a year to want to go there.
Yeah.
Want to, you know, get into that kind of...
Navigate the conversation. Yeah,
and really, as a dyed-in-the-wool Norwegian Lutheran, I'm still working on that ability to be assertive and not aggressive or passive.
So what experience, social movements, or events, or people were important in shaping you as a feminist?
I think accepting leadership roles when they came along, whether it be church or AAUW, or neighborhood, reading about women's issues. I've already mentioned my AAUW. Really, I see that as a long-range social movement. They had to convince their first research was meant to convince people that higher education did not harm women's health back in the 1880s. Social movements events in the 70s when I was working at the U in Minneapolis probably helped shape me as a feminist, again, kind of on the sidelines.
Resistance, if any, did you face from people you cared about when you became...
I think I've pretty much answered that one, too. That, you know, very supportive husband. He, in fact, now he's become really very much in charge of all of the cooking, which you think stereotypically as the wife's role. Our place wouldn't run without him.
Describe the process you went through as you decided to identify as a feminist.
It was not difficult. I think, again, it was such a slow process for me.
Was it when you first aligned yourself with the women's studies here that you kind of...
Well, I think I probably gave it the name, maybe, as a feminist. But no, I didn't need to change any of my thinking at the time.
Feminism has been described as a river with many tributaries. In other words, although feminists are united by some common beliefs, they understand and express those beliefs differently. How do you describe the tributary of feminism that best fits your beliefs?
Well, I would say that I think women should be free to choose to do whatever they want to do, with the caveat that it be a real choice, not based on often unrealized or subtle social filters and institutional constraints. I've had some of my students in Women in Life Science say, yes, but women just choose not to get into science. And my question really is, but why do they choose not to? Is it because it's still very paternalistic and the institution does not seem very appealing? Or is it because they really don't want to be scientists? I mean, is it something that they've just learned along the way, that it's very competitive, that it's not an area where you actually get to serve and help people? You know, because it often is that way, but I think it should and can change. So I'm not sure that all of the choices people made are made with all the information that they need. So choosing to be whatever is fine as long as it's a real choice.
Okay. Completely agree with that. What meaning does the feminist statement, the personal is political, hold for you?
Well, I think we are who we are in large part because of culture, that we are defined in large part by our culture, both social and political. But also we personally can help determine or define that social political culture. So I think it comes at us from both sides, realizing that who we are was defined by that, we can work to change that culture if we think that it needs changing. And certainly the political defines most of our benefits, social benefits, and so it's up to us to do what we can to help, especially if we can do it and others can't. We need to help the underdog.
How do you define power?
Well, those with power, I see, are those who have been given the ability to define what's normal. And often it's the white male. But I think we can develop our own individual and collective power. And I think women need to embrace the fact that often women's power comes in a collective, that we are, and I think that's what frightens men. Probably not, they don't even know it, but if you can keep the wife at home, and certainly this is happening in Iraq now, with all of the instability and the lack of power Iraqi men are feeling, they're taking their power out on their women, and they're keeping them at home so that they cannot assume any collective power. So I think we can redefine what power is.
How have you negotiated and balanced your identity as a feminist with constraining cultural expectations for femininity or masculinity?
Well, I think one of the things that I've learned in retrospect as I've been teaching my women's studies course is that my path in life was not just my doing, that I was really the victim of social constraints that I didn't realize were there, that women, girls, really do tend to take in as their fault most things, whereas males are much more apt to blame someone else. And so every time that I felt I was not doing well, I saw it as myself being incompetent. Instead of confronting my graduate advisor saying, when you're gone out of town all the time, you have to let me know. We have to discuss what it is that I should do if this and this happens. He was a very, you know, I just thought, gee, I should be able to do all this stuff. And we need some more people in here so that I've got some peers to work with. You know, it didn't occur to me that the things that I allowed to happen were that I had any power over them. That's just one example, but through learning more, I have realized a lot about the social constraints that are there that we don't realize are there. So negotiating and balancing my identity as a feminist with constraining cultural expectations, I think the first thing is beginning to realize that there are constraining cultural expectations. But that's really about it. You know, I don't have to be very constraining in my life at the university or with my family. With my politics, or even my church, because I go to a very Well, I shouldn't say that. The people I hang out with are all on my side, so.
And side question, what religion are you?
I'm Lutheran.
Lutheran?
Yeah. Our pastor was a chemistry major. And nice. He and his wife are good friends, and so, you know, we do have to tread somewhat lightly at church, but he is so excellent at finding common ground for everybody and has been a good role model in that way, keeping the church together, helping us all think without having to take sides. So that's probably another way in which I've learned to negotiate and balance. And I think the best thing I can do is lead by example, which I try to do.
What have been the greatest challenges you have faced as a feminist?
You know, I really could not come up with any answers to that question.
Okay. We'll just move on. Which of your contributions have made the greatest difference in shaping feminist theories and practices in your own understanding of yourself as a feminist?
Well, I definitely would have to say the biggest one is teaching my cross-listed women's studies course on women in the life sciences. Preparing for that class, I do about 4 hours of lecturing at the beginning of the semester, and then the students take over with presentations. But I've learned a lot through that, and so that contribution has been a big help for me. Also, my contributions in leadership roles in AAUW have done a lot towards shaping my feminism.
What do you consider the greatest achievement of feminism over the past 25 years?
I believe that one of the greatest is Title IX, which is not just sports, but not having been able to be in sports when I was in high school or college, not being able to take woodworking when I was in high school, really helped define who I was. Now that I have become a bicyclist, I usually use my bicycle for my main form of transportation, and that's pretty late development on my part. And it's not a sport per se or any kind of a competition, but when I'm on that bicycle, I realize how being in control of my body, showing my power in the use of my body in that way, really changes my whole outlook, emotional, intellectual as well, and that giving women the same opportunities as men to be runners even, or to be in sports, or to be in math or science or woodworking, does a lot towards helping them define who they are and to be seen as equals.
So. What type of courses did you take in high school?
There wasn't a lot of, weren't very many decisions to make. You took the maths and the science, and, you know, as a sophomore you took biology, as a junior you took chemistry or physics, and as a senior you took the other one of those, and it was pretty laid out. There weren't as many choices, I don't think. But the women took home ec, and the girls took home ec, and the boys took woodworking. The girls had separate phy-ed. We did I could be in the band, but not on the football field, you know, that kind of thing.
Excuse me. What do you think are the most important challenges feminism must overcome in this century.
Well, I would think that convincing people that we still live in a white male hierarchy, and that it's detrimental to all people, that creating equity should be embraced, not feared. When you get closer and closer, it's easy to think, well, we've made it. But so I think that's a big one, just convincing people there's a lot left to do.
Consciousness raising. When you think about your life experiences, what coming-of-age stories come to mind?
This is certainly because I knew that's what the crux of this interview was going to be about. I've been thinking about this a lot. And I believe that almost every decade was another coming-of-age story. At 10, I can remember vividly deciding that I was growing up. And then at 35, I can remember thinking, okay, now I am really grown up. But I think we change all the time. We're always coming of age. There were those official coming of age confirmation for me, and at that point it really was meant to be a very individual. You had to know a bunch of stuff. You had to be able to repeat it. You were up there stating your beliefs, and so that was very much meant to be and was a coming of age for me. The graduation was. But as far as, I think there are a lot of other coming of ages there that we don't celebrate, that we maybe should. I've come to understand that many other ethnicities, especially groups native to their lands, tend to have more coming-of-age type celebrations.
Was there ever, like, a period in your life in which you kind of felt like you were, in a way changed, or, like, you changed, not necessarily for the better, but you have changed and there was like no going back. Does that kind of make sense?
Well, I think I've had a number of catastrophes in my life. I was in a major car accident, and so I had to finish off a semester while in a hospital bed and traction, and discovered at that point that, yes, I could teach myself this stuff. And so I basically learned how the kidney worked from a small book, and then had to take an exam. And I took it with the first. I took it without the book, and then I took it with the book, and then I sent it back. And spent another semester in a body cast where I probably learned that you have to depend on people once in a while, but you can still be independent and still manage to graduate in 4 years.
So this was during your first...
So this was as a sophomore in college.
In college, okay.
Mark and I lost our first baby to pneumonia early on, and I'm sure that was a... You learn what your strengths are and how to overcome those kinds of things. My father died quite young when I was pregnant with my daughter, and... As I said, because of the way he was when I was a child, I was really looking forward to what a wonderful grandfather he'd be. And that certainly was another life-changing thing. We had a house burned down. So that helped me learn.
Was this all within the span of your 4 years?
Well, my house burned down, let's see, more a span of... sophomore in college, accident, lost first baby probably year and a half after college. another couple of years before the my dad died. Pregnant with our second child when our house burnt down. So that was maybe every 3 years or so.
Goodness.
And that plus the many moves we made from college to Minneapolis to Stuartville to Eau Claire to upstate New York, where we sold part of the company back to Eau Claire. Different houses, a couple of different places while we were in Stuartville. That plus the house burning down really helped me understand that things didn't really matter much. No. They're just things. So that was a coming of age as well. I think that all of those catastrophes had a way of bringing new light into life and what's important and what's not.
To what extent did your gender, social class, sexuality, or family situation influence your coming of age experiences and the way you made sense of them?
Well, I think gender, or at least the media induced burdens placed on women, have played a role. Mark and I had the wonderful opportunity to spend a semester at sea. If you haven't heard of that, it's a wonderful. There were 700 college students on board, and a couple of us, well, a dozen of us, lifelong learners, we were called, who could sit in on any of the classes we wanted. Everybody took a global studies class to prepare us for our next port, where we'd spend 3 to 5 days. And I think the various decades before Semester at Sea were the beginning of something that kind of, I think, finished with Semester at Sea, and that is saying, you know what, I'm 40 or I'm 50, I don't need to wear nylons. I hate nylons. I don't need to wear high heels. They're harmful for one's feet. I don't need to dye my hair just because. Let me be one of those people that helps break ageism just by looking old and acting young. And Semester at Sea was we go to places that are incredibly poor and find a lot of happy, proud women doing their thing. And so, and one of the courses I took was sustainable urban development. So when I got back from Semester at Sea, I decided, okay, I'm riding my bike everywhere from now on until snow accumulates. I haven't quite been willing to brave cars in the snow. And I'm not going to wear makeup. It doesn't make me look any better. Just, you know, the cracks just show more. And besides, if I'm going to ride my bike, I'm going to have helmets on, and I'm going to be in the rain. I can just be me, and I can like who I am just as me without having to fit the roles media puts on us. And that has been extremely liberating and freeing. So I'd started it prior to Semester at Sea, and I kind of feel like Semester at Sea finished that. And the fact that I ride my bike, I realized I've learned things about time, too. You know, you don't get here all that much faster by car. And if I was going by car, then I'd have to spend more time trying to get exercise somewhere else so I can be healthy with it not seeming like exercise. And so I just feel like I've really come into myself. And so not any particular event was my coming of age, but I think a lot of learning I've had along the way has changed me in little bits here and there. So that would be my coming of age story.
Awesome. Could you maybe just list like a few places that you went to on your trip?
Sure. I brought something. I can show you. Here we are.
Oh, cool.
Flew to the Bahamas, got on the ship, went to San Juan, Puerto Rico, Salvador, Brazil, Cape Town, South Africa, Mauritius, Port Louis, Mauritius, up to Chennai, India, Georgetown, Malaysia, up to Vietnam, Ho Chi Minh City, Vietnam, Hong Kong, Qingdao, China, Kobe, Japan, and then we just stopped in Hawaii for refueling before we ended up in San Diego.
So you literally went around
the world. We went around the world, yeah.
That's amazing.
So it was a bit of brainwashing, really. I took a whole semester of sustainable urban development and a whole semester of learning about other cultures and experiencing them, I think, to make it possible for me to make the big change of no makeup and riding my bike. Mark and I have done a bit of traveling already, that I think also, when you get to see the world, you realize that what you think is the norm doesn't necessarily have to be the norm. So I think all of those were life-changing events. And so for me, I really put a lot of blame on the media. On corporate America and the idea that we constantly have to make more and more money for those stockholders, and therefore we constantly have to be a consumer society when there are other ways of making a society work. And because of that, we have to make people buy things that they don't really need.
Thank you. Answer 35.
Yeah, a sense of freedom and health would be what coming-of-age stories have allowed me.
And then, what if any celebrations or public events figured significantly as part of these experiences? I would say your trip.
Yeah, it's public, as far as celebrations, certainly we had celebrations on the trip too, at the end of the trip kind of things, or at the end of every single port. But I think very little in other ways, confirmation, graduations, as far as public celebrations or events, there really have been very few. Marriage celebration, I guess.
What, if any, personal losses resulted from these experiences? I'd say your
child. Well, certainly the crises that I underwent, the catastrophes, there were losses. I think the major one I have now is because of who I am and what I believe, I don't have a very good relationship with my sister, who becomes extremely defensive very quickly. So we really cannot converse in that way. We still see each other, we're still friendly, but it's kind of a superficial type of friendliness. So.
What social scripts influenced the type of coming-of-age experience you sought and found?
Well, I would say the social scripts probably were the religious and small town atmosphere that I grew up in was what shaped my morals and my values. The idea of that there were good girls and bad girls, you know, and that was it. I missed the sexual revolution altogether. I think I had a strong interest in not repeating some social scripts. I know my husband, maybe even more so, which certainly influenced me because we've been together 40 years. He was not going to repeat the domineering, somewhat frightful father, nor did he want me to be the subservient, enabling wife that his mother was. And so I think his support of wanting to change that helped me become more of who I am as well.
And then, I'm sorry. What social scripts influenced, what was going on politically and socially at the time of your coming of age experiences?
Well, I lived through the 60s and the 70s. Which were biggies on a more... And I think now the social script that has a big effect on me is environmental concerns. Title IX, pay equity, those are in there too. All of these things that ask us to take a second look at the way we are living and that we need to change if we're going to save the world. So.
What insights did you gain from these experiences?
I would say one insight is that women are extremely important around the world. That unless we get equal numbers of women in every profession, because they each have talents to bring, and especially into the political arena, we don't have much of a chance. Many non-governmental organizations have already come to realize that it's only if they help the women that they're really helping, because the women help the children who become the adults. And the men tends to be more of an individual helping rather than a social helping. So I really... do see the importance of women.
What else would you like to share regarding your experiences with and thoughts about your coming of age stories?
Can't think of anything else.
Yeah. And given what you know, how would you like to rewrite or reframe your coming of age experiences?
I guess I would like to see a development of coming of age experiences that give more emphasis to it being a personal decision as to when one would be ready for the celebration. And I think that personal challenge should be involved. What comes to mind are some Native American beliefs where you would, coming of age meant going off into the wilderness and surviving. And being given a vision. And I think I often, and still probably do, let life happen. But I think if we made these coming of age experiences more challenging, more personal, more up to the individual making those choices, and then really, really celebrating them. Of course, there are some choices we can't make. When menstruation begins, should be more of a celebration. And I think in some places it has become more of a celebration, or always has. So when to be confirmed, when to be considered, when to graduate, you know, like the GRE, the Graduate Record Exam, is a big one. It's you decide when you're ready to take it, and you have been studying independently to get ready to take it. it's worth a celebration afterwards, and you have, you know, more so than many. So when do you want to be confirmed? When do you want to graduate? When do you want to be considered an adult, ready to drink and have sex and vote? I don't see those things happening really soon, but
no, I don't think so.
that would be ideal.
I wish there was a party after I finished my dinner.
You can make that happen.
Yeah. How long and in what ways have you been engaged with the UW-Eau Claire's Women's Program?
You know, I was going to look that up. It would be when I started teaching the Women's Studies course. Possibly 2000.
2000? Okay.
Yeah. That's when I happened to notice it in there, is when I started teaching the cross-listed course. So for 10 years now, I've been involved with Women's Studies.
Obviously teaching the cross-listed course. Mm-hmm. What is your first memory of the program?
Well, because of teaching that course, I decided to attend a workshop. It was kind of a Women's Studies retreat with various workshops that were involved in it. And what I remember is that it was very welcoming, very inclusive, very educational. So beginning to learn what it means to be a feminist, what feminist pedagogy is. And so that's been an ongoing thing for me.
How has the program changed during the time you have been involved with it?
Well, it started out just as a certificate program, and then we got the minor, and now we've got the major, and it's growing. It's been given more clout. So,
just very paranoid about the. what are the major contributions of the UW-Eau Claire Women's Studies to campus, community, and beyond?
I see, the Women's Studies is one of the few programs or even departments where the focus is what has been what we now are trying to focus on as a university, equity, diversity, inclusivity, and also on service learning. Those are all a part of what Women's Studies tries to be. It's not just about women. It's about all of the isms out there, and I think that's really, really important.
Share any stories of people and or events that you think are significant in shaping the 25-year history of the Women's Studies at UW-Eau Claire.
Well, one name immediately comes to mind, Sarah Harder, and I know that there's actually someone that's done a whole biography of her. Sarah, and I can't help thinking, when you, the people in one's neighborhood never really appreciate how big and important someone is because they see them on an everyday basis or they're just one of the community. But Sarah Harder, you know, really important to Women's Studies. She was really important to AAUW. She was a national president of AAUW at one time. Now she's doing a lot of other things at the national level. So I would say Sarah.
What do you consider your major contribution to the success of the program?
I see my contribution as being one of many, of doing my part, of being willing to teach a cross-listed course, of being willing to be on committees, jumping in and saying yes to projects. I've had people in my opening my home for meetings and workshops, and even just a contribution of being willing and wanting to learn about women's studies and feminism.
What What would you like your legacy in the Women's Studies program to be?
Again, cooperating with many others to improve the campus climate, maybe. Mm-hmm. No big legacy.
As you think about the future, what role do you think Women's Studies will play on the UW-Eau Claire campus, community, and beyond?
I see Women's Studies as being the place willing to ask the hard questions and continuing to try to improve the campus, the lives of men and women, students, broadening horizons.
What else would you like to share about the Women's Studies program at UW-Eau Claire and its impact, both historically and in the future, on campus, community, and the world beyond?
Well, I think the biggest impact has been for me as an individual. How I think continues to challenge how I try to teach. It's given me the opportunity to meet many wonderful, outstanding women outside of my department. Hopefully that is true about for others as well, and if people are challenged to think outside the box, it's a good thing for the campus and the community. Certainly the community, because of their focus on service learning, they have been very helpful in the community as well.
Thank you. And I was wondering if you brought a few artifacts. It looks like you have your
I was upset that I forgot to look up some pictures. You know, I can imagine a picture of my mother amongst the chickens, for example, or
that would be
maybe
great.
My twin sister, but I
we could always you could always send me an email quick and I can stop by and pick it up or
okay. So I did, there's one picture of semester at sea. There's Sustainable Urban Development Reader, which was my textbook for brainwashing. So most of this is semester at sea stuff. It's inside my AAUW. Oops, I've lost a pen, it looks like. At least one pen along the way. There's
the
inside of it. But I don't know that there's much you can scan here.
I could probably do the book covers and the picture, but I was thinking maybe I could take a picture of this.
Sure. Whatever you think is of value.
If you don't mind me, like, possibly scan these or...
No, that would be fine. We could take any of that stuff.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Would it be okay if I took the bag as well?
Sure.
Try not to lose anything.
Just put everything in the bag and take it.
Yes.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm not big on metals, so if I lose my pens, that's not
that
a big
deal.
No, it
isn't. I'm going to talk to Catherine to see if there's a way to put this on there, because that is really cool.
When I had my picture taken for the poster, I brought in a globe that I...
Oh, awesome.
So I had two pictures taken. One had me holding this bag, and one had me holding a globe, so I'm not sure which they decided to use.
Okay, that's a good, okay. Because then, if you have the globe, I can put this on there as well, and then...
Or if that's on there, then...
Put this with it. That would be great. Oh, with this book, is this what they had you read before you went on semester?
No, this was for the Sustainable Urban Development class that I took while I was at sea.
Oh, while you're at sea. Okay.
So this is one of the classes I took.
So, were they talking about developing in these places?
It was, you know, there were classes in biology and all kinds of classes you could take. So, students would take it as a semester class for credit. They did, students had to pick one or two of the ports and do some project there. But it was separate from the ports. not my favorite thing because it really, it didn't focus all that much on the
people that you saw or
on the important stuff so much as.
Are these actual pictures that you guys took? Or?
There was a photographer on board.
Oh.
And I think he was focusing on taking pictures of the students rather than the people or the places and the things that we did. This was the Global Studies textbook. And then weekly, daily lectures when you're on board ship.
Okay.
Prior and after each port. But this was the textbook for the class I took, one of the classes I attended.
Well, yeah, right.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you very much.
But this is almost all semester at sea stuff, you know. And
yeah. I think
which is was important.
It's
and AA being important, but yeah. Certainly for the university, I can see, understand why immersion experiences of one kind or another are important.
Yeah.
It was like in college I did, or yeah, in college I did go up to Mayo Clinic and do some work in for January term. But most of the time, I had to just stick close to home for January term and take classes because I couldn't afford it. And hopefully, you know, at the university here, they will work at making it affordable for everybody,
yeah.
Some sort of immersion experience.
That would be awesome. I did study abroad, which I thought was amazing. I did it over the summer.
Mm-hmm.
But I would love to do something like that. I can't even imagine.
Yeah, it was pretty unbelievable. So Beth Helwig and Michael Weil were both on that same semester at sea. Michael I knew about, and we were already friends, and they were the ones that encouraged us to go. Beth, I just met on board, and when she interviewed to come here, she had no idea we were here.
That's cool, though.
So, yeah.
I suppose if there's how many students were on there, I'm sure you get kind of close to a good amount.
We were the adoptive parents for about, I think, 7 girls. And only really keep in contact yet with one of them. It's been 3 years now. Except that our own daughter went. And it's what got her back into college.
Awesome.
So, yeah. That was important
very
too.
Very good. I don't know. Thank you again for all the artifacts. That's going to make it so much easier for everything. I really do.
Yeah, I had a
that.
Headache all starting at night and all day yesterday and went to bed about 7 last night, so I just didn't get a chance to try to find any pictures.
Well, if there's any more pictures you want to share, please feel free to email me.
Okay.
Because we are working in certain templates, so I think it really depends on how the pictures fit into the template. So if I have many options, then
yeah,
there's
well,
more
and
I
if there's some
play around with.
If there's a particular time, you know, that you, gee, can you find at least one picture of you as a child or something? You can email me too, and I certainly can dig that stuff up. I've got pretty good chronology. Almost everything is in a photo album of some sort, dated, so it wouldn't be too
great.
Difficult.
Okay.
To try to come up. If I've got a picture at all, I'd be able
yeah.
to find it. In other words. Okay. So thank you for the donut.